Number seven, update from Barris and staff.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Excited to be here today, particularly to talk about the investment policy statement. This is really a topic that we've been kicking around since probably September of last year. So we had that two-day off-site, and a lot of it had to do with governance-related issues, and so now we're seeing the first attempt to really codify it. And more recently, I think, Deborah, I think it was you who, June or July meeting, had asked to see a first draft of where are we in this process, and that's what you have in your report. So before we get into this specifically, that first draft of the IPS, we have a few pages just to outline how we got to this stage and quick refresher and all of that and what we're trying to accomplish. So if you turn to page two of that presentation, where the title slide is Goals of This Project, it outlines what we were trying to do and really focusing on the changes to the governance structure. Also integrating the asset allocation, because FFP is fundamentally different than what we've been doing in the past, and so that requires a bit of a rewrite. And then I think the third bullet point is really important as well, is that we're trying to clean the document. And I think what we had in the past was a document that we called our investment policy statement that incorporated not only policies, but also a lot of procedural and operational issues. And the challenge with maintaining that is whenever we have a change to policies and procedures, we don't want to have to do a complete rewrite of the entire IPS. It'd be nice to have the IPS be what it is and update policies and procedures more dynamically as needed. So the third bullet point is really pretty important, and you'll see that that slims our document down from a 30-page or so document down to a 13 or 14-page document, making it much slimmer. And the other point I'd like to make here is that these three bullet points are interrelated, that what we do with governance, what we do with FFP, what we do with policies, procedures, et cetera, all tie together here. And so what we're creating is something that currently meshes what we think, and when I say we, it was a combination of Varys drafting it in collaboration with staff, Gail and her team, and Tim and his team, to make sure that this all makes sense. So these are interrelated. And I'd also like to point out on this page that this is a living document. So regardless of what we come up with today, it is a living document, and we expect to review it annually with you. Even if it's just a reread of the document with no edits, fine, but at least we've done that work. And then obviously if we need to edit more thoroughly, we can and will. Page three highlights the process of what we went through, and I think what you see here is a standard process that you would expect in editing a document like this, so I don't think there's anything particularly interesting here. New language was added to capture zones one and two for rebalancing, so that is new. And the bottom bullet point highlighting that this really is a rewrite, that if we went through and tried to edit and provide you with a redlined of the last draft, everything would be redlined. Everything would be moved or deleted or changed. This was really a clean page. Let's start from scratch and write the right document for us now, today. So page four, then, is the result. It is the new IPS. So it has a new governance structure outlined that you'll see, and we're trying to codify what was agreed to at the April 27th board meeting by delegating certain functions to staff. FFP, you're going to see that pop up, not just in the investment strategy that specifically outlines FFP, but you're also seeing the bedrock laid out in the philosophy and the objectives of the plan. And so those are real key pieces that we talked about in September. Even those are key pieces we spoke with each of you when we did trustee interviews and highlighting just what is so important about it. Plan objectives direct all decision making. And it ties through the strategy into the risk philosophy as well. You'll see FFP language pop up there. Board level policy issues, I mentioned this before, makes it much easier to segregate these pieces and edit them as they need to be edited. So the investment policy statement then becomes a nice foundational document. And the directives, we highlight investment directives and investment procedures, two new documents that are much more modular in their approach. So rather than trying to edit a large, 30 or 100 page document, it's this page deals with this issue and this page deals with this issue. And as they need to be pulled out, replaced, and edited, we can do that, date it, get it approved. Nothing changes with the standard approval process. But now we aren't tied to saying we have to change this and then all of the rest is tied to it in some way. So it creates a much more modular approach. And then page five gets into some direction where we need from you. And so the asset allocation, We highlight this as that in the old world, we had an asset allocation that we would update every 3 years or so. In the new world, FFP is going to require us to update annually. So because it requires us to update it annually, let's pull that out. Keep FFP as an approach in policy, pull out the actual allocations, and put those in a directives document. And so that we expect those directives to be updated annually, let's just make that more functional and flexible to begin with. Points 2 and 3 are somewhat tied together. Economically targeted investing and ESG, point number 2, and then emerging managers are both currently in what I'm now referring to as the old IPFs, what we currently use. And they're call-outs. And when we have call-outs like this, it can be a little bit troublesome because 1 begets 2 and 2 begets 3. And as you have more call-outs and more kind of different strategies or different things, new innovation from the financial world, they all want to see us have a specific policy on these things. Our approach here is a little different. Here we're having the same language for both of these saying, look, our approach is that we're going to evaluate all investment strategies based on their individual risk and return characteristics, as well as how they combine in the total portfolio. So call it what you want. We're going to evaluate it on its investment merits. Done.
Just a quick question on item 2. Three lines down says discusses, the new IPS discusses all investment strategies will be considered. Is it discusses that? I had trouble reading it.
It's not great wording, is it there?
I think you meant that in there, and once you say that, it reasonably pulls together. And
I think you're right.
Okay. Either that or it needs an and between one of those two.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're linguists here, Ed.
That's all we got left.
We're going to be considered humorous by all, right?
Justify our existence.
I'm going to vote for that. I like that as the word.
All right. I wrestled for a bit and came up with that. All right.
And I would do the same thing then to version 3 because that second bullet point 3 is actually the same language. So the new IPS discusses that. All investment strategies.
Actually, technically discusses is not really the right word because a written statement cannot discuss. So, if you want to be really.
That all investments.
Or establishes.
Yeah, establishes. That's four.
Luckily, someone's getting this right.
Yes. Consider all investments based on investment merits.
All right. I apologize for interrupting.
And then the fourth point was just about tobacco. We currently have language in there about tobacco. Frankly, there's a question about whether that current language of 15% is even being monitored. And if it's even being monitored, does it need to be monitored, and should it be? And so that seems to be a piece of history that has been maintained. And now that we're doing the rewrite, the question comes up, do we need to have the tobacco threshold at all? So.
Yes, Harvey. Yes. I thought in the rewrite, though, that you did include it for now, because otherwise it would be policy adoption by the board to make a change.
That's right.
Isn't that right?
Yes.
It was.
So that status quo right now in the rewrite until the board.
Pending discussion.
Discusses something.
Yes. Yes. And thank you. So these are the points that we really need further direction from the board on, or if you like the direction we've taken with it so far, then the discussion is probably shorter. And then the last page of this presentation, just wanted to highlight the next steps. So as we walk along this journey, what you're seeing here today is basically the first draft. Hopefully you've had a chance to read it and digest it, have some thoughts, and thus we can have a discussion today. The discussion I would believe would lead us to a second draft, as well as a build out of the directives document and the procedures document. I think you'd want to see all of those three pieces together before you can really finalize on all of this. So this is indicative of the direction we're taking now.
Ed, would you like the board to go through the four items, asset allocation, et cetera, and
When you say direction, you're not looking for motions, you're looking for reaction?
Reaction, yes.
Okay. So with that, let's go to asset allocation. And ask board members to respond where you wish to.
And do you want to point out where this would show up in terms of directives? We've got sample directives in the board packet as well.
Yeah, Tim, why don't you actually join me? Because as we get into the discussion of this document, I think it's going to tie into the directives and the procedures, which Tim and staff are working on more closely than I am. I'm not trying to write the procedures that they follow. They're writing them. We would all be reviewing them and thinking about this. This makes sense to us. And so I think it'd be good to have you join and discuss
sure.
that a little bit.
So if you take a look, and there's no page numbers on it, but if you go back after the sample policy statement and after you've got a couple of pages of spreadsheets that have a lot of procedure numbers on it, you come to a page that says draft, right after a green page, draft board investment directive 610 asset allocation.
Let me catch up. Yeah.
Okay.
Is there a page number?
Got it. There's not a page number on it, unfortunately.
Okay, which is after the second page.
Would it be helpful to start with page 10 of the draft IPS, where the asset allocation was introduced in the IPS itself?
Sure.
And then we could go to the directive, which is Board Investment Directive 610, which would be an attachment to the IPS.
Yep. So if you take a look at page 10 of the draft policy statement, put a thumb on the page I mentioned earlier, go back to page 10 of the draft policy statement. Section 6 talks about investment strategy. And the investment strategy outlines the structure we've been talking about, dedicated sub-portfolios for liquidity, for funding benefit payments, for growth and diversifying assets. Section A talks about the asset allocation and basically calls it out that this is going to be an annual review. We don't necessarily say this is going to be an annual change, but the board's going to look at the mix of growth and diversifying assets based upon current capital market assumptions annually. If desired, make a change to the target allocations. And then we say the last sentence of the first paragraph there, the current asset allocation table may be found in Investment Directive 610 asset allocation. So when we say directives, board, you've made a decision, you've offered this directive, now it lives in a separate document there.
When we did asset allocation studies every 3 years, we looked at different asset allocations, and in looking at those, it gave us an idea of what allocation would give us what return. So we could see plainly where we could make a better return, and we didn't have the risk factor as prominent then as we do now.
Yeah.
And I'm aware of that. But that was so easy for me to understand and make what I felt was a good decision of what to do when we were doing that every 3 years. I would like to see a similar demonstration when we're making that asset allocation
yep.
change and what that's going to do to the over. And I know we've done a little bit of that, but that requires a lot of work if we're going to do it annually. I wouldn't be opposed to that being triannually, that part that gives us a thing, and you could do the individual thing, maybe make a change here, and this is why. But I really, at least once every 3 years, want to see a full-blown...
you want to see the capital market assumptions
yes.
and the asset...
You know what I'm talking about.
And what we've talked about under the FFP regime is basically the liquidity program that 48 months of the board has laid
yes.
out. That's kind of that's the sticky part. That doesn't change.
Right.
The board can revisit that at any
point. And we understand that.
But we anticipate that being stickier. The mix of the growth and diversifying, we get the annual refresh on that. And you'll get the full blown. Here are the capital market assumptions associated with the asset classes in there. Here is the overall risk profile. Here are a couple different options. Board, would you like to make a change from past policy to come up with some new targets for the upcoming, from this point forward?
Okay,
whether forward is, for the next year, the next 2 years, next 3 years, the board's got that discretion, but you get that annual look. So what you used to see every 3 years, in terms of that level of detail, now you're going to see every year.
Okay.
And when the board makes a decision to either affirm that there's no changes to to that mix or to make a change, it would show up in the investment directive.
Okay.
And that's where you're going to see all the
I may be visiting you, but okay.
That's fine.
Well, I have a follow-on to Jerry's question because I found that I'm not perplexed. I guess I'm just not maybe understanding it. I thought in the sort of the traditional approach to asset allocation that there was an element of stability in that, in
yep.
the sense that you go through a long and thoughtful, rigorous process to determine what that is, and then you set that's what it is. Action within those allocations, which this policy would now largely put on your doorstep in terms of asset manager decisions and so on, are the dynamic piece of it. I kind of thought the allocation piece under the FFP was less dynamic. So my thought was when I read this was, well, that we would revisit this annually. It struck me that it comes with that the right to change your mind annually too. And
no.
I didn't think that's what you intended.
So let's separate actions from reviews. We don't necessarily anticipate big moves or even necessarily moves every year. What we want to do is say the capital markets are always in motion. And if the capital markets move significantly, the valuations of the asset class are moving significantly. So on a forward-looking basis, if the stock market is down 20% this year, at the end of this year, the stock market is starting from a much lower base, the valuation is much lower, forward-looking returns are higher. And conversely, if we have a great stock market year, forward-looking returns are lower. So we want to get that refresh on the growth and diversifying every time, every year, just so we're current there. We don't anticipate this saying, we're going to take our equity allocation from 24% to 44%, nothing like that. We anticipate marginal tweaks around the edges there. But given the fact that these are the markets with the highest volatility and they're now in the sub-portfolio, we want to do that annual review with the board. And so if you wish to change the target allocations, you can do so. And it would really be more of a, within your growth allocation, within this large long-term growth allocation, would you like to make a shift from the stock market to the bond market? Would you like to make a move into real estate or out of real estate? So maintaining that growth allocation, but maybe changing the area of focus within that. And it's tweaks along the margin that we anticipate.
I'd probably add too that the FFP construct of saying we want to think about 48 months of benefit payments. What those projected 48 months will be gives us a cash number, not an allocation percentage. Yeah. And because of that, each year when we review that percentage of the plan allocated to the liquidity portfolio could change.
Yeah.
And then as a result of taking that number and plugging into total plan assets and thinking about where we want to be with that, what the market behaviors have been elsewhere in the more volatile markets are going to change those percentages as well. And so that is different than the traditional approach.
Is this any way like timing the market?
No, I wouldn't phrase it as timing the market. I'd say being cognizant of the valuation that's available in the market. And Ed phrased this really well in terms of we have one portion of the portfolio that's sized in dollars, uh-huh. and then the other two portions sized in terms of relative allocations. So because that liquidity is sized in dollars, we have to translate that back into a percentage term every year. That's a moving target. So we want to be able to take a look at the other two and say, do we have the right mix here?
Especially when you're looking at, as in this draft, IPS, we have the minimum 24 months. So between 24 months and 48 months in the liquidity sub-portfolio, there could be a lot of fluctuation in those numbers, which is going to impact the other allocations as well. So it's something that I think is more important to be reviewed on an annual basis as well.
Maybe it's the same question. So our 25% is a first shot at the liquidity
yep.
portion.
Okay. So that's
but
well,
that 25 obviously will vary as a practical matter every year.
Yeah. That 25% is basically we're taking a look at the next 4 years of projected benefit payments of about $1.7 billion and translating back into our current balance. Well, when we do this exercise next year, that 1.7 is probably going to look like more like 1.8, and we're going to like take a look at what percentage that is in terms of the overall fund at that point in time.
If it's of 9, it's yep. gone down. If it's of 6, it's
there. You
gone.
Go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so it's we're always taking a look at the next 4 years. We know that's a dynamic cash number, and we have to translate that back into a percentage term to figure out how to structure the rest of the program.
Seems fairly certain it's going up.
Seems fairly certain it's going up.
Hopefully
yeah.
the markets do too, and yeah. so the growth portfolio.
yes.
denominator will please go in the same direction.
Exactly.
Yes. So what we envision here is not laying out the 25% target allocation, because that will change every year as the liabilities increase and maybe theoretically in the future decrease, but they'll be in motion in dollar terms. Then we have to kind of back all that into a percentage. So we said that's going to move every year. Because that's going to be a dynamic topic, let's put it in an investment directive that the board can review every year. We know the liquidity number is going to change. You can take a look at whether you want to change anything else on the page.
Maybe this is just another way of saying the same thing, but you could have effectively said the portfolio is comprised of two pieces, liquidity and all else. Liquidity is whatever it is, and we have 100% of all else defined as growth and other.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, two ways. We had to choose one. I think your point is very valid. We could have done it that way, too.
What we wanted to avoid was having to update percentage terms in the policy statement every single year. So we wanted to be able to have a more living, dynamic document there. Whether we incorporate some of that, I mean, it's at the board's discretion. We could certainly incorporate some language, such as what you suggested.
I guess I would have thought the alternative I just roughly described would allow you to keep the percentages of whatever is not liquidity the same, as contrasted to, because liquidity changes, everything else has to change.
Okay,
that's enough.
I think they all three would be changing regardless,
either in percentages or dollars.
Yeah. I mean,
something has to change.
Yeah, it's almost coincidence if they stay the same, actually. Yeah. I would expect them all to change. I guess what we were thinking about was when we start thinking about how to start modeling out the liquidity portfolio, we have this discussion of what's in the liquidity portfolio, what is in the rest, and we could almost think of the rest as 100% how we allocate that as an easy construct for keeping our asset allocation right on those pieces, while the liquidity is naturally drawn down throughout the year and then replenished again. So that adds a little variability, and we were talking about, you know, we could do it this, like what you're suggesting there. But when we do the annual look and we say, okay, so what are the projected 4 years, I think that's going to require us to take a total view of everything, and that's how we're going to have to do that piece.
So it feels like it's actively managing the asset allocation as opposed to, well, I know I'm using terms of art and you'll quibble with it, but it just seems like the older model of the
set it
long, rigorous discussion set in stone and asset allocation, make changes within it, has really changed, because this is a completely liquidity-driven exercise that the consequences of which are potentially changes within those classes, right?
And if you think about this in terms of our cash flow profile, I think it becomes pretty clear. Up till now, we've been cash flow positive. There's always new money coming in, higher than the benefit payments going out. So it's pretty easy to rebalance back to a fairly static target that you can maintain over 3 to 5 years.
Right.
When your cash flow negative and your money is flowing out regardless of market activity, we know we're going to be in a much more dynamic position. We don't have that flexibility necessarily to always say, you know, benefit payments went out, employer and employee contributions came in, and therefore we just go back to our target allocation. Well, if money's always going out, and it's going out of one portion of one dedicated portion of the program, and we have market exposure on the other portions of the program, we do have to be a little bit more active about how we maintain our target allocations, whether via static allocations or risk profile or what have you. But it's going to have to be a little bit more of a active oversight function there.
Yeah, I just hadn't appreciated when we were doing the FFP analysis, what, year and a half ago, whatever it was, that going from the concept to the implementation is what, and we're in the implementation discussion here, and that's some realizations are being realized. And it's interesting, but it's definitely different.
Well, part of that realization, too, will be when we talk about the allocations to private equity, private credit, emerging markets, these more volatile asset classes, the reason why we can invest in those, and we want to because they offer great growth opportunities for us, but with volatility, that volatility then is dampened by this liquidity portfolio. So it's kind of this barbell approach to risk, is that we're really safe here on the investment portfolio. And that gives us comfort for 3-4 years. And over 3 to 4 years, yeah, we're going to see a lot of volatility in these asset classes, but that's the volatility we can ride out because of this.
Because of that.
Right.
Yeah. Hope you're right.
I'm very
happy. Just for the board, I wouldn't want the discussion of the liquidity import to distract you from another very important policy here, which is the risk mitigation strategy that's reflected in the diversifying sub portfolio.
Yeah.
That's something relatively new, with the idea that you need to have some downside risk mitigation in the portfolio that is not tied and correlated to the growth portion of the portfolio.
Yeah.
That's, to me, from a fiduciary standpoint, that is every bit as important as the liquidity portion of this strategy, and should get your attention, and should have some deep discussion about how that risk mitigation strategy works.
Hopefully well.
Jerry, you have a...
Maybe it's piggybacking on Harvey, but the growth sub-portfolio on page 11, the second paragraph of that, I need some education on that. I'll read it to you, and then maybe you can explain back to me what I'm reading. The success of this portfolio will be measured primarily by compounded annual growth rates in conjunction with the annualized standard deviation of returns as the primary measure of risk. Help me understand.
Clear as a bell, right?
Oh, yeah, that's...
Yeah.
Jerry.
Yeah. Is this going to... Was that a four-hour class, or is it...
three-hour tour.
Yeah.
I thought that you had sat through that class, so, I mean...
you went to one.
We basically put into long sentences and strange words what we're doing today. This is basically your performance report today, is that it focuses on annualized returns.
Okay.
We look at them on a quarterly basis, but you have the 1, 3, 5, 10-year period. So you're looking at annualized returns over those time periods, standard deviation of returns, so your volatility. We show those in the performance report as well for each of the strategies. And so that's what we're saying. We're basically looking for risk-adjusted return here, and that's how we're going to do it. So apologies for the complexity, but it's essentially what we're doing today. That
right.
one's not different.
Long term, we're not looking for income. We're not looking for right. downside risk mitigation. We're looking for long term growth on a risk adjusted basis.
In the next draft, we can probably add a sentence in there, leave this sentence as it is, but add a sentence in there that introduces it in
plainer language.
It like you just did.
Yeah, I think that could probably stand some plainer language.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a good point, Jerry. The growth portfolio, long-term intergenerational growth, we count on this in the future. We don't count on this money today.
All right.
But excellent point.
Okay, in terms of guidance, I think we've, Tim and Ed have reviewed.
Karen has.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I had a question about the actual asset allocation attachment.
Mm-hmm.
You send this to the draft board investment directive 610. I was comparing it with the asset allocation targets that are in the current IPS, looking at the categories and comparing them. And I noticed that there's alternative investments listed in our current asset allocation, in our current IPS. And I look through these categories in our draft asset allocation. Some of them are alternative investments. We may want to add sort of an umbrella category for that, and then explain the individual asset classes within it.
And that makes sense. I would actually, good point, but I would take the counterpoint to that. I think they were alternatives when the current IPS has been drafted over the years. I think they're no longer truly alternatives. They're fairly mainstream, and we just want to label them at what they were, private equity, private credit, et cetera.
I'd add to that that we had historically, as an industry, looked at these as alternatives and kind of a different way of modeling them. And today we have the better data sets and everything around each, so we're actually modeling it as private equity and private credit. And so we break it out. It's a refinement that I think is a step in the right direction.
You're suggesting your target allocation is 16% in private credit.
Yes. This is what the board previously adopted back in April. So this is the, this is what the board looked at in December. They took a look at another iteration in April.
Just help me understand the credit that you're
What is private credit?
Yeah.
Sure. Ed, you did the modeling on that one, so.
Yeah. So here we're looking at investing in companies that are not publicly traded. So like there's private equity, companies that are not publicly traded. So you're investing in typically smaller firms, but instead of taking the equity stakes in those firms and actually owning a portion of the business, you're lending them money.
You're lending them the money to make.
Yeah. So
they're paying us back at a significant interest rate so that we're making money on the money?
It's going to behave like a traditional bond. You make an investment, they pay you back, installments, and then they pay you back.
Who's going to evaluate those?
You'll be hiring private credit managers to do that.
And recall back in July, the board authorized us to conduct a search for a private markets consultant to help us design and oversee these programs.
Yes.
So there'll be a specialty consultant.
This is one of his or her responsibilities.
Yes.
This is like BCD. I think I've got the acronym right.
BDC.
BDC.
BDC companies today. I mean, I know there are a number.
That would be a subcomponent of private credit, yeah.
Okay.
They play in this space, and that's an organizational structure that they've chosen to organize themselves as the BDC.
Okay.
Yeah. Question on this particular investment, just to follow on. How thinking of Tony Cousins, how would you value this asset class? In other words, how is it marked, given that it's private equity, lending side private equity? How do we value that investment? And who's going to value it, I guess, maybe.
So you're going to have the same structure around this as you would around a private equity fund. These will be limited partnerships for the most part. So it's going to be you're going to have an independent auditor do annual evaluations of these, but really we're going to pay fees on committed or invested capital, and we're worried about the money that goes in and the money comes out. The midpoints evaluation, while important to us, are not critical to us. But it's going to have that same structure of these are private markets. It's going to have to be some judgment from the auditors on what they're worth in the meantime. But what we're worried about is getting our money back, getting our installment payments back, and getting the principal back. And so it's going to be incumbent upon the manager to do the credit underwriting and do the monitoring, and an auditor to come in and make their best case for what it's worth in the meantime there. And we're going to have relatively conservative valuations on these, as we do on the private equity.
Traditional 3-year, 5-year?
These are shorter than private equity funds, where a private equity fund is 3 to 5 years investment.
So what are these going to be, 18-month, 24-month?
Well, the private equity is going to usually, you think about it, roughly a 7 to 10-year life total.
Yeah.
These would be more of a 3 to 7-year life.
Okay.
So they've got a higher turnover rate. You're making shorter-term loans. When you're taking an equity stake, it takes a long time to pan out. We're making loans here. So we're probably making 3-year loans, but we're making sequences of them.
This is a big area that the banks used to play in, and they've been forced to get out of, and that's created the opportunity for institutional investors to organize and get invested in these funds. So a lot of these firms come out of the banks having done that kind of underwriting. They then do it to these smaller companies. These are higher risks, though they behave more like high yield kinds of stuff. They write a lot of covenants into their loans about when things have to be hit and when they're broken, and they will occasionally take ownership. They'll get warrants. They'll get equity positions in a bad scenario. That can often work out because they have the management teams to go in and work these things out and still prove to be pretty good returns. So it's an interesting dynamic, but it's largely a gap created by the banks.
Would government agency, if any, regulate that?
So the investment managers are registered investment advisors. So that would fall under SEC.
Mm-hmm.
And So it would be the SEC.
So the ones that are giving the value to it, are they regulating them?
The auditors?
I thought you said there was somebody to price them.
Right. So we'd be hiring a – we wouldn't be writing loans directly.
Yeah. Right.
I'm not going to be writing a check to private company ABC. Right. We're going to have a fund sponsor, just like we have in the private equity space. They're going to go out there and through their networks focus on a particular industry or focus on a particular type of security and write those loans. So that fund sponsor will be registered with the SEC.
Got it.
They're going to be focused. They're going to have their own valuation policies and that sort of thing. But they'll have an independent auditor. So you'll have a PwC or a KPMG or a firm like that coming in every year and saying, okay, let's track all your cash flows. Let's take a look at all your investments. And let's provide a test of, are you carrying them at a fair market value? It's the same structure that we have in private equity. We're just moving over to the credit side of the equation, of the balance sheets there.
Ed, have you seen any other funds go into this private credit like us or more and started before us, like started maybe 2 years ago or 3 years ago?
Yes.
And kind of how has that gone for them, those that you know that are in doing it?
Oh, it's gone really well. So they've generally have selected individual managers. Your experience on the private equity side is more fund to funds, and on the private credit side, the diversification across managers isn't as important. So they've been able to do individual managers and get their exposure that way, and the returns have been pretty strong. And they've experienced all these kinds of things where they've had defaults in the portfolio. How do those get worked out? And we might be going down a path, though, in terms of when we get to the private markets and spend more time on the private markets approach, both equity and credit, we can do a lot more on the education side of these things, because these do merit good discussions. And as fiduciaries, I'm sure you all want to be confident in what we're investing in. So,
but for today, we just need board feedback. Are you okay having the asset allocation, whatever it is, however often it's revised, sitting in a parallel document as a directive?
I read through all of it, and I've asked the questions I've asked, and so I'm okay with the draft and what you're presenting. So that's where I am. So
the IPS referenced the directive, investment directives, in a different document. So as long as the asset allocation has a reference to where you can find more information, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is there anybody who is not comfortable with the approach that's been described? Documents in front.
Are we going to go with the draft or not? I just only have.
I'm following the guide of Ed and Tim, but
yeah, we want to talk about these few topics where there's a question around that, and then we can go over the draft.
That's fine.
In terms of structure,
okay.
There.
I'm assuming that Rusty, we're on the four. Yeah, we've just completed one. Asset allocation two, economically targeted, et cetera, is the one we are now to in terms of board comfort, reaction, guidance.
So,
yeah, the new IPS discusses that, all investment strategies. So with that noted with two and three, that's the essence of what we're trying to accomplish there. So this would not preclude us from looking at ESG, or as they used to be known, SRI, or economically targeted investing, or emerging managers. All fair game. We want to incorporate everything out there, so it doesn't isolate them in any way, but doesn't call them out either.
So see if I understand this. The second one, Board Investment Directive 630.41 on emerging managers.
Yes.
The next one. Is that to be included
this
specifically, or I'm not exactly
so
sure.
Let me clarify here.
Okay.
There are a couple clauses in the current policy statement that came out of board action.
Right,
not
specific
necessarily
board actions.
Right, not necessarily coming out of the investment group, but specific board action.
Okay.
If the board wishes to include them, we would include them as directives, but there's also a question of, does the board wish to maintain some of these non-investment directives? If so, we would put them in a separate directive document that the board could revise on a modular basis.
So that applies to the next two or three.
Yes.
So are we being asked to look at them individually?
Or? Yeah, we provide direction. You don't take a vote today. The vote would be on the final draft, but just provide direction. A, do you want to maintain them? B, if so, are you okay having them as a separate directive? And probably flip that. If you wish to maintain them, they would live as a separate directive. The language isn't changed, just the placement.
So it's basically maintain or use the generalized language that you've used both in 2 and 3, that based on investment merits with an analysis of potential risks.
Yeah. So these date back 20 years. And whenever something dates back 20 years and hasn't been revisited, it begs the question, does this reflect the board's current thinking, current wishes? And I think that's one of the things we want to flag for you is this language has been embedded. It's been board policy for 20 years. Does this board wish to maintain that policy? If so, we'll move that language over to a separate directive that you can revise when and if needed. So we can take these one at a time.
I'm concerned procedurally. I mean, it's clear these have come out of board resolutions at the time, which accounts for how they've been worded and kind of an awkward way in which they've been worded and whatnot. But does it require then each one of these to be viewed individually, as since they were individual amendments or actions taken by the board in prior years? So can we one fell swoop say we don't want those things anymore, or we do want all those things included? And I don't know whether or not they need to be looked at individually or not, because each one of these, to some extent, one in particular, is a real can of worms. I mean, some of it seems to have been kind of pandering at the time, but, and it still is, in my opinion. But so I just don't know exactly what we're being asked to do, or what we're allowed to do.
These are current policy.
Right.
So we know we're kind of starting from, these are in place today. Because these didn't come from an investment consultant or investment staff, they
right.
came from, call it, other things that were important to the board that the board wished to kind of apply to the investment program. We would like some direction. Now, if that direction, and to your point, you know, we're not asking for a vote today, but we're just kind of soliciting feedback. Is this a policy that the board wishes to maintain? If there's a difference of opinion or if there are open questions, we can leave it. We can make it an education document. We can put it as a directive, and the directives can be revised over time. That's the beauty of the directives when they stand alone. They're very easily revised. You can take no action at this time, which would just keep it in place. You can tell us to, you know, that's not something the board wishes to maintain at this time, and when we come back with a final draft, it wouldn't be there, and you would vote on it at that point. You would essentially rescind it when you adopt the final draft of the policy statement.
So in other documents, I guess, to add some context to this, Jerry, would be to say, like, if you had something where you felt like there should be a minimum allocation or a maximum allocation of these, like tobacco, it has a threshold on it, 15%. Okay, so we have that number. Whereas emerging managers, we're not seeking to get at least 5% of the portfolio to dedicated to emerging managers, nor are we trying to cap emerging managers at 15% or something like that. We're just saying emerging managers exist out there, and they represent interesting investment opportunities, and we'll evaluate them in due course, as with everything else. So because there's no min or max, do we really need to have it in at all?
Right.
And so I think that's kind of the same logic with ETI and ESG. Totally makes sense. ESG is becoming more and more common in all of the presentations we're seeing for managers and how important it is around the globe. It's smaller here in the U.S. than it is in Europe, but ESG is taking root, and it still stands. You know, they still have to answer the same question. Okay, I like what you're saying. It makes me feel good, but we have an obligation to our participants. So is it going to improve the investment risk-return profile for the plan if we invest in it? And if they can answer yes to that question, then absolutely, let's bring it forward. Let's do it on those merits. So again, we don't have a min or a max set to ESG, so do we need a policy around it?
Would anyone like to suggest that we do or we don't need a policy? Harvey?
Just procedurally, and I agree with the recommendation to kind of wrap these into the general policy statement, but these were policies adopted specifically by the board previously, and whether we've been honoring them or not honoring them, they're still on the books as your policy. So I would recommend that you take them one at a time and to decide whether you want them as a standalone policy, whether you want it to be as recommended, subsumed in the overall policy, where we take all economic opportunities and risks into account. But take them at a time. A good example is the Emerging Managers Directive that you got. This is basically a pledge by the board that you won't beat your spouses.
Really?
Fascinating statement. I'm glad it was adopted.
Does anyone want to challenge Harvey on this?
But, you know, we don't have a policy to exclude people based on race, gender. Yeah, I think that's a good statement of where we're at. Whether you need a specific policy on that, probably not. But I would recommend, since they are specifically adopted policies, that you take them up individually and either abandon them or tweak them or restate them or make them yours. And if you have to keep them, draft them onto the policy in the addenda directives.
Yeah. How many of these are covered under the investment directives or management procedures?
These would all be investment directives. So these are all kind of, they're in the main body of the policy statement today.
Right.
They don't reflect investment program goals necessarily. It's the board's goals. And so if the board wishes to say, you know, there is some factor that we would like you to consider outside of what you would normally consider on the investment side, here's a directive. And so these naturally fit here. The bigger question for us is, given how old these are, I want the board to either, as Harvey said, either abandon them or make them your own. Either own them or let's take them off the books here. And if we keep them, that's fine. We just want to make sure we've got them reflecting current board thinking here. And these are ones where we need the board's direction, because these are not coming from the consultant. These are not coming from the investment program organically. These are coming from the board organically. Understanding not this composition of the board, but the board itself. 20 years ago, 15 years ago. Some of these are dated, so we have to take a look. We want to make sure that we don't have a policy against dogs barking that was put on there in 1900 and never maintained. If we're going to have a policy, we're going to enforce it.
I'm glad you brought that up. I want to make a proposal. Okay. Barking dogs.
Karen.
So just to add some background to this, some boards feel very passionately about social or economic, responsible or irresponsible factors, and when they do, they try to direct their investments that way to the extent they can, still complying with their fiduciary duty to invest prudently. Some boards feel strongly about that. Some boards feel strongly about, no, we just want to look at investment risk and returns, nothing else. And the question today is, where are you?
Yep.
Would you like these or others incorporated, or would you like to not incorporate them with the next iteration of the IPS?
I'm, for one person, more comfortable seeing a more general kind of a statement that, I mean, it's almost as if you're saying we're an equal opportunity employer. And in the course of making our decisions about investments, we will do the following. You know, we will not make any decisions that disadvantage a gender, a new company, or whatever it might be that we want to put in sort of a general thing. I'm less comfortable, and obviously just because I think it's just an incredibly slippery slope, on the specifics with regard to things like tobacco.
Fossil fuels.
I'm sorry?
Or fossil fuels.
Yeah, that's right. You can go down the list. I mean, do we want to have a policy? Somebody's going to say, well, then if you got one on tobacco, and I realize it's there, then you have to have one on firearms, military industrial complex, sugar, you won't do any kind of business with artificial sweeteners, fossil fuels, gluten, GMOs, good gracious. Eventually we're down.
That's
with
the point.
You're going to put all of your money into a passbook savings account, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I forgot the one, unappetizing labor agreements. I don't want to come off as anti-labor, not in the slightest, but it concerns me sometimes when individuals come in here and try and get this board to take a position against an investment because somebody in Philadelphia doesn't like the labor agreement that's being discussed or whatever it might be. It seems entirely inappropriate for me to have us dealing with that. So I
And some of these are, you know, the discussions.
Specificity is bizarre, in my opinion. I'm
in a corner.
And just some of the discussions around these are lost to history.
I agree. It was a hot button at the time.
It was a hot button at the time for emerging markets and ETI. I do remember what the tobacco divestment was about. It was when the tobacco settlements came through and the creation of First Five. There was a board discussion around that. But given that some of this is lost to history, if it's going to be a policy, we've got to own it. So if you want to own it, let's talk about the language we put in here. If it doesn't reflect the wishes of the board currently, let's talk about removing it.
I think Jerry has suggested we remove in general, and I didn't hear Burma in there, but...
I'm sorry?
You didn't put Burma in there, but make sure we're fully covered. Is there anybody
who... It's
not
a complete list, I'm sure.
Anybody who feels strongly, well, not strongly, if anyone feels that we should not be going to a generalized statement for guidance to Ed and Tim. That is guidance from the board, and I think it's probably time to take a six-minute break, and that's now over 2 hours, and come back.
Six-minute break. Not to put too fine a point on it, but
7 minutes. Come back at 11:15.
New broom sweeps clean, man.
Recording paused.
To 11:15.
You don't have that much. I'm sorry. You're like the legislature. Just stop the clock. 11:59.
You don't have those power. All right. Ed, Tim, would you like to proceed?
So I think based on the discussion right before our break, we were heading towards the direction of addressing items 2 and 3. To Harvey's point, we should probably handle them individually. So. As we're looking at point 2, it sounded like the direction was to go with a more generalized approach. Point 3 sounded like the discussion was to go with the more generalized approach.
So that would mean there are no individual directives around that. It's subsumed into the general investment language. Okay. Yes.
Are you, Ed,
I mean, that's a good
4
point.
Should be held out separately. I would have viewed 4 as being included as well, but...
Well, so on to 4 then. Do we feel the same about 4?
Does anybody feel differently about 4? They'd like to keep a specific 15% max in a tracking? And
John?
Harvey?
If you decide to subsume this in the overall policy, I would want the record to be very clear that the board is not voting to reinvest in tobacco. Okay. That is not what the board is doing. Then we should have another agenda and have a conversation on it. So if that's anybody's thought, I think we need to talk about that. So this would be a vote to say that our tobacco policy will be part of our overall investment policy. That is not a vote to reinvest in tobacco.
But we're not going to have a tobacco policy, I thought.
Right.
It's up to you.
General.
So I guess another way of saying that would be if we proceed with removing the 15% and removing the specific tobacco call out in the policy or the directives for that matter, any of the documents, we aren't going out to any of the investment managers and saying, hey, here's a change in guideline or anything like that, nor are we directing anyone to go and start investing in that. So, and if we were, that would actually require separate board action to do so.
Yeah. Because the public equity managers, they have separate accounts, have this restriction embedded in their investment management agreement, and we're not talking about revising those today.
Okay. With that being said, does any of this impact any of those kind of agreements?
Thank
or
you.
Anything?
Good question.
They have to, once you adopt the final investment policy statement that governs, you know, the entire administration of the plan, and every investment manager has to sign off that they have received, read, and understood the investment policy statement.
That's all investments going forward. Right now.
So if they read it and they say, we have another restriction in our investment management agreement with you that requires this, can we now remove it? We would say, we can have that discussion with the board. It would require board approval to remove it.
Yeah.
Okay, any further reaction back on tobacco?
Okay, then the next step would be the document itself and the draft. And again, we're trying to keep comments, suggestions, edits as directional as this is the first draft and making sure we're getting the concepts right. We also recognize that it's not a perfectly wordsmithed document either. So we will take those comments into consideration, but recognizing that we'll have a lot of eyes looking at it before you see the next draft, and hopefully we'll catch most of those kinds of things in due course.
Question maybe for Harvey's talking, but I guess this draft represents a significant enough change that it's, I wonder to what extent the archival references to the prior amendments make any sense, or how important they are to have there.
We'll refer that over to the legal team.
Oh,
and so
later date or not?
It's interesting because on page 2, we have the amendment dates in here, and we're calling this a restated document as opposed to an amended document.
This is kind of like when you do a code. Some agencies for years dealt by resolution and ordinance, and then someone comes along and says, hey, we should codify all this and put it in the code and put numbers on it. And so there's a history following every section that parenthetically references where it came from, what ordinance in 1906 or whatever it's from. So is that the thinking, that archivally you want to reference from whence it came or its derivation? Is that the idea?
Essentially, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
But I think we want to be clear that this is a restatement, not an amendment. So we try to find a common ground there by saying having the restatement date as well.
Well, it's amended and restated. I mean, it's mm-hmm. a complete.
I'm just not sure what the references add. And who's going to go back and say, you know, I went back to 1486 and I found some significant differences here.
Well, it is the current iteration of the policy statement that's been in effect since 1986.
Yeah, there may be some, historical value, Jerry. I don't know. I'm not debating it necessarily, but there might be some historical continuity value to knowing the derivation of, you know, this new amended and restated investment policy and from whence it came, because in 10 years when we're gone, hopefully, somebody else will be looking at this, and they might want to get back into tobacco. Or whatever, and then they'll want to go through the iterations, right? And understand if someone might want to thoughtfully look at the entire history.
Okay,
I don't know. I mean,
I just wonder if that's
I can argue it the other way if you want.
I'm sure you could. I've dealt with people like you before. On the one hand, but on the other hand, yeah.
It's a pretty lively conversation. But
Were you thinking at all of going through and highlighting significant new issues, or are you relying on everybody recalling what they might have had a question on and now raising it?
I could walk you through the table of contents. It's probably a handy way of doing it.
Okay.
Just giving a couple talking points on each of these main topics, particularly as it applies to our 2013 version. So purpose is pretty obvious. In the prior version, we had an introduction. It's basically the same thing, just relabeled. And then part two is authority under both. Part three is governance. And we spent more time here calling out the roles and responsibilities.
Are we going to discuss each one as you cover them?
Sure.
Please. I mean, I had no comment on number one, or purpose, but number two I talked to you about, and Karen also, about some of the language missing there in the citation.
In the first bullet point?
Yeah.
Okay.
First bullet point, we will take direction to add language for the rest of that citing that we have there, because there is an important section about minimizing employer.
Well, and it's not verbatim, even though you're citing the code, and that missing section should be included.
Just a thought for your consideration, would it make more sense to just go through page by page and see if people have comments on it? Individual page, as opposed to going through the table of contents. Like, anybody have any other thoughts on page 2? Just a thought.
Works for me.
Okay.
Jerry wants to turn pages.
Okay. The short enough document, I think that works well.
I didn't mark my notes.
Jerry Holcomb has a legal question we were going to ask Harvey.
Okay, RB?
Legal.
Wake up, Matt.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Jerry's.
What was my question? Could I have my question read back to me?
Question was, what was Jerry's
about
question?
About the amended versus restated.
Oh, I think I understood. I mean, it was just basically to what extent is it important to have all of the amendment dates in there for archival purposes, and could you put that in the form of a verbal response, Counselor?
Yes, it's important to have to state in the policy the date of the adoption of the original policy, the date of the restatement of the policy, and all amendments.
Okay, I was watching Harvey as you were saying that, and he's going like this, and so somehow I took
that. That is our practice, and there's good reasons for it.
All right.
Situations where we need to research back in time why something happened, why something was discussed. It's very helpful to have that.
Got it. You're going past the point of sale now. I withdraw my question.
It's not needed for the policy itself, but it aids the interpretation, like you see, and you open up your 37 Act and they have all the amendments to a section. So
okay.
You can go back and research what was in effect when.
Nicely restated, Counselor.
Rusty, did you
have a... No, I was just curious if CC Sarah had all that information on the amendments, what was actually amended in the document in a single file somewhere?
I wouldn't say single file somewhere, but yes, all of the agendas and minutes and agenda materials are part of the permanent record of the system.
So you'd have to visit each policy as it was amended to determine what the exact change was. We wouldn't be able to tell it from a single source.
A single source showing all the amendments?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, okay.
So don't make a public record.
Yeah, it won't. Just curious how you did it.
Okay.
So your question regarding the authority section, Rusty, was that a legal question too?
Yeah, it just left out a part of the sentence between two commas there.
Oh, okay.
About minimizing the employer's contributions. That's not in there, as it is, of course, in the law in 2013 policy statement.
Yes, we can include the legal provision.
Page three.
This is your governance.
Right.
This is your decision. Part of this whole exercise over the past year was to review a variety of governance models, and over the course of a few months you've made some decisions and gave some direction. Here we encompass what we think we heard the board say, but this is your first draft and your opportunity to look at it written and see if you have any questions and any direction for changes.
As we go through the pages, could you just highlight what sections are new? Which is pretty much all of it, but I mean,
it's
for
all
example,
new,
the governance
pretty much everything.
Well, later when we get to asset allocations, obviously that's not
facetious, but yeah.
It's just been watered down.
Yeah.
But obviously, this section is new, and that's where we should be perking our ears and confirming what we already discussed before, whether we're sticking with this as it's written now.
Item one talks about and lists those subject areas that the board retains sole and exclusive jurisdiction and responsibility over. And you have a list of those items in the bullet points, the governance model of the investment program, the investment policy, objectives, asset allocation, risk philosophy, engagement of board consultants and service providers, and monitoring the investment program.
The monitoring the investment program, I have a question about that. It's not a question, I just have a statement. that's going to include the annual reports. So that
quarterly.
Is that, or, and the quarterly.
Yeah.
That's going to be the monitoring process.
Quarterly performance reports, annual.
Are there any other monitoring processes that you were thinking of besides those?
In terms of what would be reported out, certainly from the consultant, you'll have the quarterly performance reports. You'll have an annual review of capital market assumptions. I think from staff, you'll have reports out of cash flows. Is the liquidity program working as intended to pay all the benefit statements? So you'll have that as a monthly document there. There's going to be a number of other smaller iterations, but those would be the big ones that, at the programmatic level. How is this working here?
Well,
and certainly if the board feels like there's a question that's not answered.
I'll touch on something else I was thinking about. Back in the report, it mentions on sites, and that I had a feeling that board members were being somewhat excluded from doing on sites, and it wasn't keeping with what the previous practice has always been. And I would strongly object to that. And so when monitoring an investment program, there's an investment fund that comes into trouble and you're going to do an on-site, I would appreciate being informed of that and then asking to see if there's staff that want to do something or go with you on that.
You mean trustees?
And trustees. Also, as part of that?
I'm sorry, trustees is what I'm talking about.
We do have an on-site due diligence policy, and we're not advocating that we change that at this time. And part of that is including trustees in that process.
I hope so.
So it may be some specific verbiage that you may want some changes in the IPS on. Uh-huh. We can go over that.
Yeah, I think the language, and I'm not seeing it here, but the language I recall was trustees are not required to attend on-sites, but are invited to attend on-sites.
Invited.
So what we've talked about is we have an open calendar. We'll let you know where staff is traveling. If a trustee wishes to join us.
That's welcome. Thank you.
Hiring a new manager. That's the top paragraph on page 7, the last sentence there.
There we go.
But, Jerry, are you referring to?
Hang on, I'm going there. Page 7? Yeah.
Yeah, that's three.
In portfolio monitoring, I think we can have the same sentence added to our policies there.
So, do you have issue, but may not be required to?
Yes, yes.
That changes it a little.
Yep. So that's what I was referring to. In fact, I highlighted it.
Okay.
And the last line, the CIO may but shall not be required to request the involvement of one or more board members in the due diligence process.
We can change the language there. Take a look at it.
Would you like to make it shall?
Yeah.
Request?
Shall be required. Yeah, shall.
Shall be required to request.
To request.
I see. Shall request.
Or shall indicate to the trustees that this is going on. If you want to come, let me know.
So are you uncomfortable with it, but shall not be required to? So if it were to the CIO may request the involvement of one of our members, are you comfortable with that?
Yes.
I think what you're saying is
shall
the
request.
CIO shall request.
I had shall as opposed to may. As
okay.
Take
yeah, let's do
may
that.
And everything between the commas out.
I want to be careful here about, because this is on the due diligence side, I want to be careful about any unintended consequences of that could be interpreted as board members have to be involved.
Right.
No.
I don't think that says that.
Yeah.
Shall request.
No. If you don't, you need to give justification why it's not appropriate for a board member to be there. But other than that, I want us to be invited.
And what I want to get to is point where we say we have a process for underwriting managers and conducting due diligence, part of which is an on-site. The board shall be notified of upcoming on-sites and may attend if so desired.
That's perfect.
Because remember, we're taking, and here's a little wrinkle here, we're taking the on-sites and moving them earlier in the process. So to date, the on-sites have been after the board has approved a mandate, then
that's
you go
true.
On-site. And to me, that's too late. You haven't answered all the questions, but you've made a decision. So we're saying we're going to move that on-site prior to final approval of the mandate.
Okay.
And so we can certainly give the board guidance about upcoming visits and that sort of thing.
Well, I just don't like, but shall not be required. I don't like that phrase.
Feels too harsh?
Too harsh.
We'll take a look at it.
I think the proposed
rework it somehow
actually gets you there.
Proposed, maybe if we just take out, but shall not be required to.
The CIO shall request the involvement. I mean, yeah. you can let them, CIO can let the board know of any upcoming visits.
Yeah.
So I want to be sure I'm clear on the sequence of things. Seems to me the biggest fundamental change we've made, or a fundamental change we've made in the approach is, we're not picking horses. Right. You are, mm-hmm. In terms of manager selection, based on our oversight and you know, rules and policies that we're going to follow, in including all the asset allocation discussion we've already had. So to that degree, the former function of us going on a due diligence visit after, you know, selection subject to final approval was to sort of go kick the tires, have that final discussion a little more in the weeds is one way to put it, getting a little sense, a better sense of management and whatnot. But ultimately, in that scenario, the board had made this selection, right?
Yes.
Following interviews and a RFP mm-hmm. or a funnel process. In this environment, you are going to be actually making the selection based on the input of Barris and others in terms of, you know, the scope of your search and then winnowing it down to get to a manager. So what do you see as the role of a board member in the pre-selection due diligence visit?
And see, that's where I think the phrasing here was, you know, this is a very procedural level of getting into those weeds and basically checking the boxes here. And so at the on-sites that are envisioned in this paragraph, the level of detail is kind of incongruent with a policy functioning organization. If we're, I'm trying to think of a really easy example, it's not coming to me here, but to me, there's nothing that would preclude a trustees from saying, we have questions about what's going on at manager A, and we would like to conduct a special visit. That's part of, there's nothing here that precludes that. What we're saying is, you know, we're not necessarily embedding trustees in that due diligence process. We should be able to come back to you and say, we've conducted the research, we're recommending this manager for this role for this reason. You, board, is this consistent with the policies and goals you've laid out? And if there's still questions, trustees can conduct whatever additional visits they want. But it's that, you know, that due diligence is part of the research process. And we should really try to separate due diligence from education.
Yeah, so I think in this environment, just based on some of the concerns that Jerry mentioned is, maybe the way to go at it is that as you make this change, as we fundamentally change how we're doing manager selection, it might make sense in the early stages of that, think a year, 18 months, whatever the appropriate time frame is, to involve to make an effort to involve trustees in that, yeah. So they can literally see what's happening,
yeah.
And because it's part of the fiduciary obligation, as long as we understand at a very granular level what's happening, aside from what gets reported back, it might help in terms of, because it's a fundamental change in how we're doing it. So I guess the advice is, in the early stages, some involvement might be useful. My sense is it would likely trail off.
And I think that's probably a fair statement. Yeah, and as I said, we're not saying trustees shall not attend annual meetings. Trustees shall not do any of that. We want to continue that ongoing relationship with the firms that you have question marks about, or you want to get something additional out of that contractual relationship with a particular manager in terms of education. But we do want to start to migrate this from trustees getting educated and doing oversight versus what's conducted on the due diligence phase, because they really are, language-wise, we've combined those historically, they really are separate functions.
Right. We should be able to find the right balance, though. So, I think what Tim and staff are talking about is actually one of the areas that is almost a potential conflict with the board. And so you have an obligation to fulfill your fiduciary obligations. They want to do things streamlined and efficiently so everything gets done. So as your investment consultant to the board, I would say that you should absolutely have the opportunity to participate in those, as Scott's saying. And I think our discussion in private credit is a good example of that. Mm-hmm. And so new asset class, we'd be looking at new managers. These are not the same as what we've seen everywhere else.
Example.
Participating in that discussion, even if you're a fly on the wall, and listening to them drill down on the details of what they need to know, is probably going to just really hit that home for you. And you will feel better as a fiduciary fulfilling your obligations and get to participate. I think that'll be a good balance.
I still don't like this wording.
Well, I think we're taking the wording and changing it. I think shall is the direction we're heading with that.
Thank you.
So if we take out that middle piece and just say shall, is that okay for you?
Yeah.
Shall invite instead of request.
Shall invite,
Invite's a little softer, but
inform.
Inform.
Notify. Yeah, so we'll find.
And what about ongoing due diligence?
Right. So that came back to Jerry's original point, because this came up under portfolio monitoring. Portfolio monitoring is actually on page 13. And here we just have a brief paragraph really talking more about essentially our traditional performance reporting and such. So on site with trustees, I think is a similar framework. Invite one to come along and take a look, or, you know, as a result of our quarterly performance review and you hear about manager XYZ isn't doing things we thought they should be doing it, let's find out more. So I think that has to be incorporated there too.
Yeah, I'll tell you, for me at least, as a newer trustee, when it occurred, a couple of those visits where I attended, didn't know a lot, but I learned a lot on the spot and on the fly. Got a real up close look at the situation. It's very helpful.
Yeah,
very telling.
It's one of the things that, as a trustee, I've always felt was really helpful for me, and it really gave me an insight into what we were going into. And
yeah,
I mean, even as simple as, do you have a backup in case your primary computer system goes down? And where is that? And making sure that they can cover their tracks if something happens. That seems like a simple thing, but that can be a huge thing if it happens.
Ask Delta.
Can say Delta is coming as we
speak. Boy, ain't that the truth.
Ask them, right?
That's
right.
So I think we were up to page 3.
rolling.
3 through 8, as Karen had mentioned, this is the governance. This is the heart and soul of the changes we've been discussing here. So not only do we have the roles and responsibilities outlined on 3, 4, and onto 5, which I think you'll see changes, obviously. I think they're straightforward enough and happy to take comments on those. Part B gets into the delegation of authority, and this is where we created zones 1 and 2. And we had been talking about, I think, red, yellow, green zones, and we ended up that there were just 2, and so anyhow, we went from color coding to just numbering. But this concept of having a rebalancing zone, so this is a change in policy, because historically we had twice a year and as needed. And now it's saying we're actually turning over, rebalancing within zone 1, zones to be established. So we have to come back to you with what those numbers and ranges look like. But zone 1 falling into staff, and they can just do it. Zone 2 being they have to make a proposal to you before redoing it and get your prior approval.
There's a paragraph, that just the last sentence, that help me understand it, please. At zone 2, 1, 2, the third paragraph, it's 2 lines. It starts with portfolio rebalancing. It says portfolio rebalancing may occur by adjusting allocations to individual investment strategies or through the use of overlay provider using derivatives.
Right.
Overlay provider using derivatives. Help me.
So this is.
I probably should understand that, but I.
You recall the board took action to hire Parametric for cash overlay. This is that. So saying if we want to rebalance to equities, we can either bring individual managers up to target, or we can put a derivative overlay on there that says increase our exposure using a S&P 500 futures contract. And so it's one of those implementation tools that said if it's more cost effective to increase or decrease exposure to an asset class
so
using derivatives.
It's putting in or taking out
yes.
more funds. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Without moving the individual manager and incurring those transaction costs.
Got it. How you doing, David?
I'm Overland.
Open heart surgery is a lot easier.
We then get into managing investment strategies and the hiring new manager. And here we have the language around the $100 million threshold. And we add a bit of clarification there about having two vintage year funds under one manager with a commitment of $50 million each would hit that threshold of $100 million. So that was a point as well in past discussions. I think that was approved at the April meeting.
I have a question regarding this. I have no problem with it going on or with doing it, and it's in the policy. But I'm looking at, say you really like a fund, and you put $75 million in January, and in November you see it's really, so you put another $75 million, and you're over the $100 million thresh in 1 year. Are you going to come to us when something like that happens, when you're actually going to be over $100 million in a year going into one fund?
Actually, I wouldn't be able to do that under this policy.
Right. Oh, okay, then I misread.
I could put 75 in and report that out to the board.
Yeah.
If I wanted to put another $75 million in, that would require board action at that point, because it would be crossing
that's
that
what
threshold.
I was. Thank you.
There's a sentence about cumulative commitment.
Just wanted to make sure that wasn't available. You know, suddenly we're looking at $400 million into something that we
now it's thought we had. It's a hard $100 million cap.
All right.
And that applies in year 2, 3, and 4.
It applies to the relationship. Yes.
Right.
Okay. No strategy.
if you could take a minute and go.
You just had to.
Somebody had to do it.
Yeah, sorry. You want to shoot him now or later, David?
if you could go over when the manager returns funds and how that factors into this limit as well.
Yeah, I think what we talked about here conceptually is.
You're so bad.
We want to be able to maintain. If the board says we have a manager and. Or if board or staff says we're targeting X number of dollars with this manager and we'd like this to be a long-term relationship, and let's say that's $75 million and we invest with them, they deploy capital, they return capital, and it's drawn down to 25, we could still kind of come back up to that original level there. If the board says this is something where we want $300 million and it's in a drawdown structure, and we deployed the $300 million and it all pays off back down, we could still top up to that level there. But it couldn't go above the $100 million top up without board authorization. So if we're maintaining a desired allocation, that's a little bit more autonomous. If it's setting up a new relationship and it's above that $100 million threshold, that comes to the board level.
Tim, what happens when you reach your cap? You're doing these investments, so you have a great return. Over your $100 million turns into $120. Does that $20 automatically get shifted into that?
Well, we're talking about commitments here. So we can put $100 million of exposure. If that $100 million turns into $200 million, actually great. Wonderful.
That's right.
We're over the moon. We're talking about the commitment level, the entry points, not market movement.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
But I guess another way of exemplifying that would be if you committed 80 and it increased to over 100, he still has room to commit 20 more, even though that has grown to over 100.
Yeah. We're really focused on that. What kind of capital are we putting at risk? If it grows, wonderful. We always
Not
hope
if.
It grows.
When?
When it grows.
What are you going to do with additional capital calls? Later in the vintage, later in the life of the fund, if you've committed 100 and there's a call for another 10 2 years later.
Well, the 10 would come out of what you've committed to it. So if you committed 100 and they called 90 of it and they make that additional capital call for that remainder 10, it's already part of that initial commitment.
Yeah. What if they've already called the entire initial commitment and there's a later supplemental capital call?
For contingent liabilities and that sort of thing? something's gone wrong at that point, at which point the board is notified.
We would have already been discussing it at that point.
Yeah.
The next section, though, on page 7 gets into closed-end, new closed-end fund investing with an existing manager. And so here we talk a little bit about follow-on investments.
This is what I have.
To maintain the intended exposure.
And Gail, I think this is what you were touching on earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
Should be required.
We also have the language there on the bottom of page 7 about terminating existing managers. And giving CIO authority to do that, along with emergency terminations and how those will be handled. The emergency termination is very, very similar to what we have in the existing or the old IPS. Investment philosophy, investment objectives, and investment strategy kind of tie together, with investment philosophy being a higher level thought process behind our September meeting, our trustee meetings, and then investment objectives, boiling that down one layer lower and thinking about what we're actually trying to accomplish. And that all lines up very well with FFP, which you don't see in the document itself, but FFP being the structural format that we have been using to create the investment strategy. So asset allocation overall, and then discussing the three sub-portfolios and the interaction between those portfolios. Pause there and see if there are any questions on that, because FFP is something we keep talking about. Now that we're codifying it, is this actually representing what you thought we would be representing?
I'm sorry, Ed, are you talking about item 4 or preceding that?
I'm talking about the... Yeah, section 6, investment strategy, beginning on page 10.
Okay, okay.
And then 6A, asset allocation, we have a reference there to a directive that we talked about earlier that actually lists the asset allocation investment directive 610. It's referenced in the first paragraph of on page 10, 6A.
And then on page 11, an important note here is that we talk about the liquidity portfolio being drawn down to, it may be drawn down to at least 24 months of projected benefit payments. So again, this was where we were talking about, well, if the market all corrects, like in 2008, we want to be a buyer in that market. Values are low, let's buy, and we would want to be able to use the liquidity portfolio as that source of funds. But we wanted to put in a stop, a floor here. So we put in a floor of 24 months. So at that point, we'd be looking at what the projected benefits are for the next 2 years and saying, okay, we're going to maintain at least that. Let's see what's available then and make our allocation based on that decision.
So let me understand this. The only way it helps me is I feed it back to you. So we're set for 48 months. Suddenly there comes this great buy in the growth portfolio. So we take 24 months of our liquid portfolio and use that money to buy into the growth.
Exactly.
The board would
but
have
But we still
that.
Have 24 months.
Yes.
That's the maximum you could
All take. Right, I got it.
I got a question. So in that first, let's see. So in the second paragraph, I'm back at 6A, asset allocation. In the second paragraph, we say the board will conduct a periodic review of the strategic asset allocation to mean an optimal allocation. But I thought earlier we were having the conversation that that would be at least annually.
That's right. We anticipate doing it annually. That's right.
So do we want our policy to reflect that we want to do this annually? So the way I view it is, if it's not in this document, then we are leaving it to our CIO and investment consultant to do it when they feel it's necessary. And I'm just wondering, from a board governance standpoint, do we want at least annually or at least biannually or some sort of parameter there or a threshold?
We have worded it this way, like in general, an approach of saying this gives you the freedom to do it annually and you'll be fulfilling your duties as outlined in your IPS.
Mm-hmm.
That way, if you decide not to do it for whatever reason, agendas or whatever, and you push it off 18 months, or to 18 months, push it off 6 months, something like that, you're still okay because you've said periodic. So that's why we took this approach, but I hear you, so we're open to this.
I would think that maybe the board should at least want to be mandated to consider it annually, and if it comes up on our agenda and we say, gee, we don't want to do it right now, let's put it off another 6 months, we can take that vote and do that.
Mm-hmm. So consider it.
Yeah. Yeah. Just so you understand how this is going to work with the procedures, because you do see a little bit more generalized language in the policy statement that gives the board some flexibility there. When we get to the procedures, it's going to be, the consultant will deliver this annually. The CIO will deliver this annually. So we're putting it on us to do that. We're giving the board some flexibility to override that if you want to.
Yep.
So we want to have procedurally this locked in, but the board have some flexibility.
Tom, I think growth portfolio.
Second.
So we do have a requirement that capital markets expectations will be looked at annually, which is a natural lead-in if we want to go further.
Yes.
Because at some point, if the board decided, oh, you know what, let's do it every 18 months or 2 years, that seems to work better for us, we wouldn't actually have to go back to this document and make that edit. I think that was kind of an intentional using periodic review.
We won't, we will.
If we say we're going to do an annual review and the board decides we don't want to do an annual review, let's do it every 18 months, 2 years, we would need to go back to the IPS because we would be out of compliance with the policy.
Yeah.
So we kept it a periodic review just so there's flexibility. But if the board feels strongly like, no, I definitely need this in the IPS, that's something we can change. But it is handled in the directives as well.
For me, I feel like I want to be conservative on the first go around. So I would say leave the annual in, and if 2 years down the road we decide, oh wait, this doesn't fit, then we can change it, and change the policy. But I'm at a conservative piece when I look at reviewing things. So
I
would like to go annual. I don't know how you feel.
Yeah. So after having opened this can. I think the explanation that if it's in the directive and it's easier to change those directives, I'm okay as long as we've got something in, a lower level that says we're going to look at this annually unless we change the directive.
Yeah. So we wanted to put the restrictions on kind of the operational side so you have greater clarity there, but when possible, we try to maintain a little bit more flexibility for the board.
I mean, I think I'd be okay with that, but
all right.
Certainly I understand.
My conservative side?
Yes. Because I'm usually there with you.
Better safe than sorry.
We're staying away from politics now.
I think we need to show it to you. We have it here, and we need to show you the directive so you're comfortable with that.
All right.
Okay. So I'll make a note that we'll leave this as is for now and bring it back with the directives and make that clear.
So where were we?
So we were wrapping up the FFP discussion on page 12. This right above investment strategies, there's the note that under normal market conditions, it's the last sentence of the third paragraph, the balance in the liquidity portfolio is expected to vary between 36 and 48 months of projected benefit payments and expenses. So again, 48 is when we top up. We just get the employer contributions. It's as high as the liquidity portfolio will be over the course of the year. That will draw down. We expect that it would draw down 12 months or so over the course, down to 36 months. So we have that outlined here. And again, under normal market conditions. So creates a little bit of a wiggle room in case market conditions are abnormal.
So that is
right.
So is the board comfortable with receiving an annual funding plan from staff and then also receiving a monthly report on the progress of the funding plan and what's going on there? Is that something the board is comfortable with?
Can't miss that.
You stated it.
lost focus.
Take another point.
So is the board comfortable that with staff presenting an annual funding plan to them and then also on a monthly basis providing updates on the progress? which is indicated in this paragraph. So I just want to, because this is, I mean, the liquidity sub-portfolio is really, I think it's really important that the board fully understand how this is, the mechanism and how it's going to work and the reporting that the board is going to be receiving on this.
Would the updates take the form that we're now getting of the portfolio balance sheet?
No.
I would think it'd be different.
Kind of a new?
Yeah, it would take a look at, basically, it would show you month by month how the portfolio is built to provide benefit payments for, you know, the 40 to 36 months. And then it would be a scorecard of what happened last month, what securities were sold or matured to make this benefit payment. You know, did we pay off 103% of that benefit payment and we had surplus cash? Did we pay off 99% and we pulled down some from a cash buffer? Are we recommending any course corrections, et cetera? So it's that level of granularity.
So it's like a bank statement, kind of a
maybe closer to that, yeah.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah. It's a scorecard.
Tim, is that distinct green, red, from what we are now receiving and we will continue to receive?
Yep.
Actual target variance?
Yep. Okay. So this would be more of a, for the liquidity, we project, you know, we had these projections of benefit payments. We cash matched the portfolio to meet those. How close was the actual benefit payment to our projected? How closely did we match that with the portfolio? Are we recommending any course? It would be a new report. So on a monthly basis, you'll have a report card on the liquidity program. On a quarterly basis, you'll still have Veris talking about the overall program. And I think on an annual basis, you probably would be seeing something about the growth positioning and the diversifying positioning from staff. So we're trying to match the level and the frequency of reporting to kind of the frequency of cash moving through the system.
I'm good with that.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyone have any concerns with what Tim just described? Okay.
On page 12, investment strategies is the part we were discussing about in terms of general investment criteria being applied to all strategies, looking at risk return and how they contribute to the overall portfolio. The second paragraph there is focusing on fees and expenses, recognizing that lower fees are preferred, but we're really looking for value. So if value can be demonstrated, we're willing to pay active management fees for above benchmark returns plus coverage of their fees. So that's just called out there a little bit. And then wrapping up, risk philosophy ties in the concepts of volatility and drawdown. So volatility being the standard deviation of investment returns that we would normally expect, drawdown covering those worst case scenarios and preparing appropriately. The second paragraph there talks a little bit about how the liquidity portfolio helps us in terms of the FFP construct against the risk and diversifying. So it serves an important purpose, which we talked about, kind of this barbell approach to risk. And then portfolio monitoring is pretty straightforward in terms of the reporting that we do today, and we'll take note to add something about on-site visits with trustees. Page 14 is your appendix.
I will say with the two appendices, you see an investment procedure list. These are currently in development. And then the next appendix is the investment directives. So this is a table of contents listing of the directives that we foresee being implemented. Well, with the exception of some of the ones that are tobacco and such that are going to be pulled out. But there will be an annual review of the CIO delegation of authority. We are changing a number of the things that we're doing, so there will be corresponding governance and compliance activities related to that. There's going to be a lot more of those than we're currently doing. And I will say that this document has generated a number of discussions on a team level with our CSERA's compliance officer, CSERA's legal counsel, myself, Tim Price with Veris, and I think that I think I can positively say that you know, what has been created has been through a development of different people's perspectives being brought up and having a further discussion, and I think the end result has been a better product than if we just had one person writing it up. I mean, Verus has definitely, this is, you know, definitely been, they've been developing this document, but it's been, we've had a number of very robust discussions on what to include. And obviously, we take this very seriously, and we want to do what's right for our plan. So if there's anything, if you have any questions on any of their procedures or directives, or, well, what about this, or anything like that, and if nothing comes to mind today, but as we go through it, if anything comes up, feel free to contact myself or Tim or Ed.
You know, I just want to say I've been very pleased with the way this whole process has progressed at a very steady but even pace, and we've had the opportunity to opine on various places, but yet you have continued to push forward and keep things moving. So thank you, all of you, for sticking with this.
Ditto.
Thank you. Yes. Long process.
It's an investment.
I've thrown enough arrows at you, right?
It is so worth it, though.
You've done well.
Yeah. We get this right collectively.
I won't say it. I'll tell you later.
Yeah. When these are off.
Yeah, I'll be back.
Ed, Tim, do you have the guidance at this point that you need?
I think so.
I feel like I do from my perspective.
Yeah. So next steps for us is go back, incorporate board comments in the policy statement, build out the policies, procedures, directives, come back in several weeks with that full body, that full documentation, and then let the board have a final look at the policy statement and take a vote. Probably we're looking at end of September.
Okay.
Okay.
Very good. A lot of work, my friend.
Okay, we are...